had a dream that I found a beautiful, unusual necklace. I think you'd call it a choker. Heavy, shaped like something ancient, of intricate silver and oval, luminous, large stones, a kind of milky, glowing stone. If I wanted it, I could have it. But I woke to my 1.5-year-old Lucy crying before I could decide to take it. I dream a lot of jewelry, of finding it and of losing it. I know that my dreams are very important, really, as my heart, which, as I speak now, is beating, slippery, strong inside my chest. I know my dreams are important, yet I don't pay enough attention to them. My best friend Rachel and I talk about them sometimes, and sometimes I feel I'm about to discover something important, but I get distracted. Who has time to figure out what dreams are about? I have to change Lucy's diapers. I have to pick up 10-year-old Matt's endless Legos and the inside-out socks I find lying around. I have to work. I write ads for local businesses and the United Way. I have to go to the store and buy milk, eggs, butter, hamburger. This treadmill of my life takes precedence over figuring out what my dreams are about. I live in a small town in New Hampshire. It's so beautiful, but also kind of slow. Not a lot happens here. The fall is especially beautiful. I love seeing the maple trees change color. They remind me that time is passing as I fall headlong through my life. The one across the street in my neighbor's front yard turns an orgiastic orange, all the shades of orange like those in my son Matt's new giant-size Crayola crayon box, those perfect pointed sticks of color named rusty gold, maize, mahogany, burnt sienna, and bittersweet. But something strange is happening with the maple at the end of my street, where the little woods begin. It's turning red instead of yellow. I'm sure it used to turn yellow because I took pictures of it, but this October it's red. Can trees change the color they turn? Maybe it's sick, like my best friend Rachel, who has breast cancer and 2 little children. The trees remind me in this headlong fall through life of the season and the place, my outward life while my interior stays hidden, the blood from my faithful heart whooshing through my veins, my vocal cords striking one another with a wet thud as I speak these words. I know this because Matt and I watched a science program on TV showing how vocal cords vibrate, how our hearts look when they beat, and our blood rushes like a red river through our veins. It showed an aneurysm, too, a ruptured blood vessel spewing into the brain and pieces of brain tissue floating about like cotton candy. This hidden life inside my body and in my dreams goes on while, on the outside, I'm the mother of Lucy and of Matt. I'm a wife married to Lucy's father, Jack, who adopted Matt, my son, from my first short marriage. I'm 34. When I was 30 and a half, this was a few years after my mother had smoked herself to death, I stopped drinking. It happened like this. I told Rachel I was worried about Jack's drinking. She told me to talk to her friend Lynn, an alcohol counselor. I went to see Lynn. She listened to my worries about Jack's drinking. He drank at least a 6-pack of beer a night, and really, he seemed more interested in beer than in me. And Lynn said, "Do you have any worries about your own drinking?" Oh, I did. I told her of how, when Matt was only 2, and I was already divorced, raising him on my own, I'd gone to a counselor at the local mental health center for help with my troubles, including worry about my drinking. The counselor had asked, "If someone put a bottle of wine on the table, would you have to take it?" I thought it was a strange question. No, of course I wouldn't snatch a bottle off a table. "You're not an alcoholic," she told me. Later, I learned she had run away from her husband with another married counselor. I told Lynn of my first memory of alcohol, a shimmering red-gold drink in a stemmed glass, my mother's favorite, a Manhattan, and being given the maraschino cherry in the bottom when I was a child. I spoke of what had, beginning in college, come to be my frequent drunkenness and awful hangovers, of the times I couldn't remember what happened. I told her about what felt to me like my excessive interest in drinking, of how I was always looking for an opportunity to drink, and once I began, how I drank too much, despite my resolution not to do so. I told her about how when I was an announcer at a local radio station and our boss was away, my fellow drinker colleagues and I would go out to a many-cocktail lunch that left us staggering back, laughing over one of us pressing a naked bottom against the plate glass of the sound booth where our colleague on the air was startled into stumbling over his words. Lynn explained that I was not too young or too healthy to be an alcoholic. Alcoholism, she said, was like an elevator that you could exit at any floor. You didn't have to go all the way to the bottom. If you want someone to tell you not to worry about your drinking, she said, but kindly, don't talk to me because I'm telling you you're right to worry about it. She loaned me books about alcoholism. I had family members who drank too much. My mother was a polite drinker, refilling glasses of sherry surreptitiously from the pantry, sometimes drinking white wine while she ironed in the morning. A brother and a sister had troubles with alcohol. My father's sister was alcoholic. Their father had been a binge drinker, and I'd heard the story about him locking himself in the garage with a loaded shotgun. But I knew nothing about the disease. I thought that to be considered an alcoholic, you had to be falling down in the street. I didn't drink all day. I didn't have health problems. I wasn't falling down in the street, though there had been some occasions when I had fallen down inside the house. I'd grown up in the 60s, and I didn't even use drugs, if you didn't count nicotine, because despite having seen my mother die from lung disease caused by her smoking, I did continue to smoke. How could I be an alcoholic? I just wondered why I kept getting drunk when I didn't intend to. For a few weeks after my meeting with Lynn, I poured myself a scotch, using my grandmother's one-ounce shot measure, a silver thimble with the words, "Just a thimbleful," engraved on it. Measuring was one method I was using in order to convince myself I was not drinking too much. I poured the thimbleful into one of the crystal highball glasses I also had inherited from her. The drinks, kept me company as I read the books Lynn had loaned me, "I'll Quit Tomorrow" and "Under the Influence." Then came the evening Lynn took me to my first AA meeting. Having explained in one of our counseling sessions that she herself had learned a whole new way of life in AA, and I could too. I had not had a drink that day. Though there were plenty of meetings nearby in New Hampshire, we crossed the Connecticut River and drove 30 miles into Vermont to a meeting in a white clapboard church. I liked the meeting. I felt an immediate relief and kinship as I listened to the drinking stories told by farmers and professors, and I was impressed by their honesty and laughter. Lynn said, "Take what you like and leave the rest," and advised me to see what I could identify with, not what I might think was different from me. Though I did differ in some ways from each person who spoke, I also identified with every one. The AA meeting with Lynn was definitely interesting and helpful. I thought I'd go home and have a nightcap and think about it. But we turned the wrong way on that dark country highway, and because of all that Lynn and I talked about on our long ride, by the time I got home, I decided I wouldn't have that drink. Because of AA meetings, Lynn's guidance, and my relief at not having to worry, cover up, endure hangovers, not know what happened the night before, fall over, slur my words, talk too revealingly about myself, tell others what I thought of them, scheme with myself about whether or not I could have more to drink without anybody noticing, feel guilty, justify, rationalize, and endanger myself and others, I had driven more than once with one eye closed, watching the center white line on the country road. I had not had a drink in the 3 years since the night Lynn and I got lost while driving home. And though the common wisdom was that you shouldn't make any major changes in your first year of sobriety, I had purposely gotten pregnant. If I was ever going to have another child, now was the time to do it. Inside me, Lucy went to a lot of AA meetings. When my son and my daughter were infants, they seemed still to be part of my own body. I'd wake sometimes hearing their thin, dependent cries inside my head before they'd actually begun to cry. I knew the cord had been cut between us. At both births, I'd watched the doctor cut it with his surgical scissors. Yet I felt that each child remained, for a time, as connected to me as if that splendid, bluish, muscular cord still stretched from their tiny bodies into my own. Now, however, as Matt, at 10, acquires the faint odor of approaching adolescence, and Lucy, at 1.5, proclaims words, I can forget their existence for a few hours, and then they sometimes startle me. When did they arrive? And how long have they been here? Where did the child I see in old family photographs, me, go? I take Lucy to a babysitter for a few hours each morning so I can return home to try to write stories, a book, in the sunlit enclosed porch, and I ignore the egg-encrusted plates, the dusty tabletops, the unmade beds, while I work in the sad warmth of the October sun. Poised between 30 and 40, I'm turning a new color like that maple tree. My husband, Jack, faithful to his nightly six packs of beer and often more, does not like my going to AA. At every meeting and with every AA friendship, I grow. Rachel, my best friend, born one day apart in the same year as me, has breast cancer. If I don't try to leap toward the larger life I long for, I may never have it. How can I stay with my husband? How can I not? A well-known writer is coming to speak at the nearby college. I've been reading his novel and puzzling 10-year-old Matt, who prefers television to books, by sometimes laughing aloud as I read. I'm laughing at the writer's description of his erotic pleasure in reading. His excitement amuses me, though my own appetite for reading comes from hunger. I greedily take out more books than I can read during the library's loan period. I go to hear the visiting writer's afternoon talk and enjoy his polite answers to a sweating professor of English who says, "When you deal with this question of time within the space of actual time of the novel, is this narrative time like other time, or is it what you might call marking time? I've never heard anyone talk that way before." I'm thrilled by the writer's simple presence, only 10 feet from my red upholstered chair. I want to speak to him, but reluctant to be one of the crowd waiting eagerly at an awkward distance, I leave the hall after his talk. Outside, though, standing in the late sun, toying with my car keys, I suddenly decide to go back in and shake his hand. He takes my arm and asks me to have a drink in the lounge of the local inn, whose familiarity is transformed for me by his company. As I drink my Coke, we talk about writing, the sweating English professor, our appetites for the printed word. What interests this middle-aged married writer about me is not, I know, our conversation about books, but what interests me is his citizenship in that larger world. He offers like a small hors d'oeuvre, an encouraging word about my writing, and suggests we get together again while he's in town. My husband Jack, to my surprise, sees my excitement when I arrive home. I feel heedless, wild, like that aneurysm shooting blood into the brain. I need the steadying influence of the trees, of the view of the mountains from my staircase window. I have two children, a husband willing to love both. I have this old house with its flowered, faded wallpaper, its fireplace, a real dining room. I've tried to fit myself to this town, to this husband who reads only Sports Illustrated and the newspaper, who does not want to stop drinking. I've tried to fit myself to the malnourishment of writing advertising copy, feature stories, and slideshow scripts. To want more is to suffer from delusions of grandeur. But the next morning, after I've gotten Matt off to school and Lucy to her morning babysitter, I meet the writer for coffee, and we take a walk. I want to show him our public library. Picture this. A couple standing between tall shelves of books in a library built into the surrounding pines. Above them, dark green branches moving softly against the windows. There's a faint odor of mustiness, and perhaps the glue on books recently bound or rebound. Downstairs, an insect-like sound of voices, a decorous exchange between the librarian and someone asking about a book. It's slightly dark between the shelves, private, hidden. The sun, cool because it is October, streams in and almost reaches to where this couple stands, not touching, just looking at a book. We say goodbye. We've agreed to meet again that night after his public reading. I spend a dreamy afternoon. I talk to Rachel for a few minutes on the phone to tell her about my excitement. I feel exhausted, but the floor needs vacuuming. Lucy's laundry basket is filled with urine, damp clothes. She sleeps, and Matt plays at a friend's house while I go about my duties. At dinner, Jack doesn't like to hear that I'm going out again. "You look nice," he says accusingly from his end of the table. "That's a nice sweater you're wearing." I'm surprised he noticed it. I have, in fact, just bought it. It is my commemorative coin for this occasion. Matt says, in his 10-year-old wisdom, "He's just jealous, Mom. That's how jealous husbands act on TV," and we all laugh. "I'll be home early," I say as I leave the house. Waiting in the lecture hall for the reading to begin, I think I won't after all meet this man afterward, but how well he must know this. When I hear him read, I'm full of admiration. He seeks me out afterwards, touches my arm. We walk with some people from the college through the cold night air to the inn, my throat from tension or the cold, constricted. We settle around a table and talk for several hours about books, writing, writers, places these people have been or are going to go. I'm not going to be going anywhere. I mostly listen, twirling my peppermint-striped cocktail straw from my club soda. Like a person who has almost died of thirst, I want to gulp their company. One of them, a woman, is not so much older than I am. She has 3 children and a well-regarded book. How, I ask her, did she do that? "I was tired for about 10 years, she answers. I come home late. Opening the door, I'm struck by the warm smell of my little animal family, the ever-present socks on the floor, the red and yellow embers in the fireplace, the dinner I cooked for my family still in the air. My 3 satellites spin silently in their dark orbits. Slipping into bed beside my husband, I fall into a deep sleep and begin to dream. I'm entering a shop with the writer who tells me there's a treasure inside which has been saved just for me. I see with a shock that it is the same necklace I dreamt about before. He says, "Try it on. You must try it on. It's perfect for you." I know I can't afford it, but I pick it up, I fasten it, and it settles with a sweet weight around my neck, its luminous stones glowing.